While we were marching through Georgia, everybody swing your honey, swing your high and low. The Alaman left for the old left, and around the ring you go. A grand old right to left, walk on your heel and toe. Promenade that pretty gal to Georgia.
It was getting near closing time in Columbus, Georgia on April 21st, 1843, and the cashier and the teller of Western Insurance and Trust Company had just finished their tea and were ready to close for the day. The cashier and teller move into a back room to settle accounts for the day and put the money in the vault. The newspaper accounts say they took a little time to procure a light and make some other arrangements. Remember, this is 1843, in the same year A Christmas Carol came out. So you can picture the whole scene, like Bob Cratchit lighting a little lamp and standing behind some tall, spindly desk with this huge ledger on it. Little did they know that they were being watched. Three men were hiding in the back room of this bank, crouched in the darkness and awaiting their opportunity. When the bank employees had counted everything, they opened the vault door and the robbers sprang. They put out the light and choked the two bank employees. One of them had a nasty cut on the collar of his coat, obviously where one of the robbers tried to slit his throat. The money was taken out of the vault and the two employees were locked in. The robbers go out the door and into bank robbery legend. The teller and the cashier would spend about 3 hours in the vault until their calls for help were heard. The best account of this robbery comes from the New York Herald. It's a letter from a correspondent in Columbus named William Morton. The night of the robbery, William Morton was up the street attending a lecture by a notable phrenologist. You might remember Eula Mae Thompson and the bumps on her head from February. If you do, you know what phrenology is. William Morton was walking home from the lecture with a lady friend and discussing what they had heard. Incidentally, he thought the whole thing was rather boring. Then they suddenly heard a strange noise. After some time, he determined it was coming from the bank. He disposed of the lady, the letter specifically says he disposed of the lady, and gathered some people for help. Entering the bank, they found the teller and the cashier locked in the vault. William Morton did ask how three robbers could have gotten into a bank, passed two employees into the back room, and hidden without being noticed, and they answered that, well, it was getting dark. The bank teller, a fellow named Alan Bass, let it drop that while they were counting up the day's receipts in the back room, he noticed the front door was unlocked and went up to lock it. That may not seem like a significant detail now, but it will become very important soon. The police were called and both employees told their story and gave descriptions of those that had robbed them. The next morning, a reward of $5,000 was offered for the return of the $50,000 to $100,000 that had been stolen. I love reading books about the early days of police work. Without fingerprints or DNA, the police would sometimes employ rather unusual methods to solve a crime. In the case of this Columbus bank robbery, the assistance of a mesmerist was sought. Mesmerism is an early form of hypnosis, and between phrenology and mesmerism, this is quickly becoming one of my favorite episodes. The newspaper account says that this mesmerist magnetized a boy. Now, which boy? We don't know. It doesn't say whether he was a witness. It doesn't say whether he was involved in any way. It just says that he magnetized a boy. Now, this boy apparently declared that the money was still in town, that it would be found that day, that more than one person committed the crime, and that one would be arrested that very day. And that is some top-notch police work, including predictions for the future obtained from, well, by hypnotizing someone that had nothing to do with the crime. The mesmerist provided that information to the police in order to add to their thorough and scientific investigation. Maybe they came in afterward and read the bank employees' tea leaves from the night before. And of course, what really makes this strange is that later in the day, some of these predictions would begin to come true. Later in the morning, an investigator, or possibly a volunteer, came to a room occupied by Thomas McKean. McKean was a prominent lawyer in Columbus. He had a good, solid reputation and was married to a lady of good family from Alabama. The newspaper specifically mentions that he was a well-regarded member of the Methodist Church. Why on earth would someone come to the home of a local lawyer at 11 a.m. the day after a bank robbery and ask to be let in so they could search for the loot? None of the contemporary newspapers say anything except that some pall of suspicion had fallen on McKean and they had decided to search his room. And you can add to that the eyewitness account from some ladies on the street who had seen him planting a rather large geranium in a pot early that morning. So a vague suspicion and someone planting a geranium. What kind of police work is that? Well, according to the paper, it's skill, energy, and perseverance. Either way, someone entered McKean's room, pulled up the geranium, and found about $4,300 buried under it. McKean was arrested and taken to the police station for interrogation. Now, those of you who are into The Wire or The First 48, you know that sometimes these investigations can go on for hours and hours. In this particular case, the authorities threatened, cajoled, they tried every trick they had in the book for fully 4 hours before conceding that this guy was a brick wall and would never talk. 4 full hours of interrogation before giving up. Now, after the police grilled him for, well, you know, not even the whole afternoon, the question came up of whether he was going to be charged for the robbery. And, of course, the officers of the bank chose not to. They offered him full immunity for information about the robbery. All McKean had to do was turn over what money he had and the names of the participants in the robbery. Since his reputation would be ruined in Columbus, the bank would even pay for him to relocate with his wife's family in Alabama. I'm actually a little surprised they didn't throw in the $5,000 reward while they were at it. McKean gave over the money and information and got on a train for Alabama. The people of Columbus were furious. Some went off on their own to try to intercept the train, and some grabbed the bank manager and demanded an explanation. The sheriffs ordered the train to be stopped, and McKean was brought back to Columbus to be locked up. One of the questions I had was how could you bring McKean back and lock him up after an immunity deal had been given and he had provided that information? Well, it's because he had an immunity deal with the president of the bank, not the local law enforcement. The bank had promised not to press charges if he gave up that information, but that is not legally binding. The state could still arrest him and charge him with bank robbery. And that's exactly what they did. Once he was locked up, McKean's story became generally known. He and a fellow named William Jackson had cooked up the whole robbery and involved the bank teller, Alan Bass. Jackson and McKean entered the bank the night of the robbery and spoke with Bass, who was a little annoyed that they had arrived so late, and then they were escorted into the back room where they could hide. They hid behind the bed in a bank. When they jumped out, Bass played his part and pretended he was so frightened of the two that he pointed out a few boxes with money in them that the robbers would have otherwise missed. McKean, Jackson, and Bass all confessed and all were convicted of bank robbery. You might have noticed that in the initial stories, there were 3 robbers in the bank. Nobody gave up the name of the third robber or even acknowledged that there was a third robber. However, about $5,000 of the bank's money was never recovered. Some suspicion was on the Georgia Solicitor General. He was actually indicted for receiving stolen goods and taken to trial, and after a very long trial, he was acquitted. This is Moving Through Georgia, and I can always be reached at movingthroughgeorgia@gmail.com. I'm really excited to tell you that I have two live shows coming up. The first one is Saturday, April 6th. That's at BSG Cafe in Cornelia. That's a new place next to Big Daddy's. Next, on April 13th, at Sweet Southern Creations on Washington Street in Clarksville. It's more or less across from the theater. Both will start at 3 o'clock. They'll last about an hour. No admission, of course, and both will lean a little more heavily on true crime than I've done in other live shows. The Cornelia show will focus mostly on Cornelia and the Clarksville show on Clarksville. If you've done a Haunted Habersham ghost tour with me, this is all new material. I'm not reusing any material from the ghost tours. And I'm really excited to get out and meet some people who are listening to the podcast. So if you can make it on April 6th or April 13th, I'd really love to see you there. And one last postscript to this story. The Georgia Journal for 1845 has a short article in which they describe what they call a melancholy tragedy. Mrs. McKean and a few others were visiting a friend near Athens, a retired colonel. The colonel went up to bed and shortly after heard two gunshots. When he came back downstairs, Mrs. McKean was dead. She had been shot in the head, and the one next to her was mortally wounded. I haven't found any other mention in the papers about that case, and to the best of my knowledge, it was never solved. You do have to wonder, however, if it possibly could have had something to do with the third robber. It would make a good mystery story if it did. A grand old right to left walk on your heel and toe, from an adept pretty gal to Georgia. That's all.